Okay, so let's begin. Does anybody have anything to say about the homework last week of learning to say no? Stella, I know you have a story.
Well, oddly enough, I said no to somebody just this evening. The volunteer who delivers my groceries from what's called Neighbour Food. It's like an online farmers market thing on a Thursday evening. She keeps bees, and I buy things from her that are not through Neighbourhood Food. I bought my beeswax candles from her. Anyway, she said that this week she's going to see her friend who collects pollen from his bees because her mother wants some, and did I want some? And I was, without needing to think about it, I was able to say no, thanks, because I have lots from the first lot you bought me. So that was easy and didn't require any effort, and it didn't require me thinking, oh dear, will I hurt her feelings if I don't have another pot of the stuff? But no.
Good, but that's the important thing about learning how to say no, just gently and softly, because otherwise we end up doing stuff we really don't want to do. Stella, you had a story.
Yeah, so with me it was like with a friend of mine, and we were saying we've been trying to meet for a long time, for just for a coffee. And he was getting from Tuesday to Thursday and then the following week. And I could tell the pattern. I've had that before with another friend. And I could feel the hurt rising in me and the anxiety. So I just asked her to just give it a break and not to meet, to discuss about meeting until after the middle of November or at the end of November, because I just couldn't cope with the maybes. And it is a pattern. I've had another friend who did it, arranging to meet and then she disappearing. And I'm thinking, you know what? I can't be bothered with this. Like, there has to be a no somewhere. And because it's not coming from the other side, there's this maybe, which we could dialogue, but I thought, no, I'll just say no. And I felt better afterwards. I felt very peaceful. Because I'm not sitting there thinking, oh, will we say Thursday and then it won't be Thursday because she'll be busy somewhere or whatever. I don't know. There was something about that that felt good.
Lovely. Anybody else? Sally, did you have a story? Yes.
Yeah, two incidences. One, when I was asked to do something for a niece, usually I'll try and oblige, but I just didn't want to do it, and I was able to say, no, I'm not feeling up to it today. And again, similar to what Stella said, it felt very peaceful. And also another incident with a friend of mine actually just saying quite firmly no to doing something I didn't want to, which again, I wouldn't, normally have done, and I'd have said yes and then worried about it, all the rest of it. So yeah.
Marvelous. Gail?
Well, I have a tendency when I'm talking with my husband about a choice, about, say, a meal, some kind especially, and I'll go with what he wants to do because it's just easier than arguing about it or whatever. And he came up with, I think it was a chicken dish he wanted, and I said, no, I really want fish.
Good.
He argued a bit about it, and I said, no, I really want fish. I didn't get upset. I just said, no, I really, because I really wanted fish. So we had fish.
Fabulous.
Yeah, and it felt good. It just felt like a weight lifting or something.
Yeah, it is. It's extraordinary, the power of no. Anybody else? Anne.
I've been saying no to work. I've decided that I'm not taking on any more work between now and the end of the year. So I've had various inquiries about work. So just no. So just saying no to that a lot. It's felt very honouring of my own time. That's been the interesting thing.
Yeah.
As opposed to putting them customers first, which is what I normally do.
Absolutely marvelous. Chris?
I do a lot of volunteering. A lot of volunteer work for people. I mean, technically I'm retired, but I'm busier now than before I retired. And I finally told Johns Hopkins no for something. And I think they were aghast, but thank you for being honest. And I said, that doesn't mean I'm going to say no again for other things.
Well, of course it doesn't, but did it feel good?
Oh, yeah, it did.
Yeah, Good. Keep it up, everybody. Anybody else with a no story? No point in asking Kathy, because Kathy's never had a problem saying no. Sally?
I just wanted to say, a bit like Chris, really, that it was the reaction as well, because people were surprised in both instances, but accepted without question.
It's extraordinary finding out that no is acceptable, because we've been taught all our lives that it should be yes. Oh, that's lovely, everybody. Thank you very much indeed. Okay, I'm going to go and hit the PowerPoint now and start the show. Okay, so we've got part four of Reclaiming the Divine Feminine today, and I'm going to tell some stories tonight. They're not actually meditations, but you might want to sit with your eyes closed to listen to them. So be sure, if you're listening to the recording, that you're not doing anything that needs your full attention while listening, because otherwise you might get distracted, and we don't want that. So we're starting off right at the beginning of the Bible. It's still biblical this week because there's so much in there that's rich and so much in there that's misunderstood. So we'll be talking about the Marys, Mary the Virgin and Mary Magdalene and Eve and Esther. So let's start off with Eve. And the whole timbre of the story of Eve in the Garden of Eden is that there's a serpent. And this is really interesting because practically every other faith in those days honoured the serpent. They thought serpents were part of medicine. They were really, really important. And the image on the slide there is the snake goddess from Minoan Crete with a lioness on her head, apparently. It looks like a cat, but it's meant to be a lioness. And I was at school, I was taught that this was a priestess, not a goddess, because, of course, in a Church of England school, you were never going to be taught that it was a goddess, because that was absolutely unacceptable. And what's possible, but nobody knows it, but nobody knows for sure, there's a constellation in the skies, which is known as Ophiuchos, or serpents, which is said to be a man holding a serpent. Now, it could be a woman holding a serpent, but nobody knows what it is, but it's a human being holding a serpent as a constellation. And I think it's entirely plausible that it could be part of the representation of the goddess with the serpent. Because, of course, in quite a few cultures, the serpent is a fertility symbol, so very much associated with the female. And the Hopi people in North America performed an annual snake dance to celebrate the union of snake youth, which was a sky spirit, and snake girl, which was an underworld spirit, to renew the fertility of nature. And during the dance, the live snakes were handled. That would have been fun. And at the end of the dance, the snakes were released into the fields to guarantee good crops. The snake dance is a prayer to the spirits of the clouds, to the thunder and the lightning, that the rain may fall on the growing crops, is what the Hopi people say. And of course, in other cultures, the snakes were the umbilical cord. There's the snakes on the caduceus of Aesculapius, the healing aspect. The great goddess often had snakes as her familiars, sometimes twining round that sacred staff. And they were worshipped as guardians of the mysteries of birth and regeneration, which is exactly what we're talking about with the divine feminine. And the snake bearer in the star map there, his elbow is exactly on the equator, so he or she can be used to determine latitude, in exactly the same way as Orion's belt is used on the opposite side of the sky. And as the Minoans are the only civilization that undertook high sea navigation across the Mediterranean all that time ago, they knew how to navigate using the stars. So that would have been a really, really important constellation. So the hypothesis that I'm throwing out here was that the feminine, with its snakes, had to be discredited. And the five books of the Torah, which are Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, Leviticus, and Numbers, as we know them, are the end product of a complex and long literary process, written, oral, and both, and that didn't come to a close until after the exile. The exile was 586 to 539 before the Common Era. And the writing down of the Torah was pretty much a response to the crisis of exile. People had to write it down to make sure that people didn't forget. And much of the Old Testament as a whole can be explained in a similar way, because if you remember, We've got the E text about the Elohim, and we've got the J text, which is Yahweh. The Yay or J are identical in Hebrew. And the section from Genesis 2:4 to 3:3, which is before Eve takes the fruit, is thought by scholars to be part of the oldest textual tradition. Paleography and linguistics would date this section to about 799 to 700 before the Common Era, which is 100 years before the purge of the temple. And they locate its dialect to the northern kingdom of Israel. And they call this part of the Elohist text. And the J text was once thought to have been written about 999 to 800 before the Common Era, but recent scholarship updating it now puts it after the period of exile to about the 6th century before the Common Era, because it's written in a dialect associated with the city of Jerusalem and the kingdom of Judah, which is the more southerly of the nations. And the northern kingdom of Israel was destroyed at the time of the relocation of the temple. And the priests of Judah seem to have incorporated the E text into their J text tradition after that. And there are sorts of blends and occasional duplications and repetition, as we saw earlier in the books of Chronicles and Kings. However, there is also a feminine tradition in the Kabbalistic tradition that tells the story of Eve in a completely different way. And I'm going to read it to you from a book because it's beautifully written down here. So if you're comfortable and if it's safe for you to do, close your eyes and just listen to this story from the feminine tradition. In the beginning, the Elohim created the heavens and the earth. Why? To create a cradle for the baby that the Holy One wished to bear, for Adam Kadmon, the only begotten of God. And when the Elohim created the heavens and the earth, she created also the angels and the archangels. She created animals and fish and birds and man and woman. And they lived in a matchless world, an endless world of perfection and beauty, and all was very, very good. But nothing changed and nothing grew. And the soul of Adam Kadmon had no being and was lifeless, for it had nothing of its own, nothing that made it unique, nothing to strive for, nothing that made it conceive of any moment that could be separate from God, where it could make a decision for itself. For God did not know how to create separation. All God knew was absolute and perfect, and so there was a stalemate. Then one day the Elohim was passing over the waters of the earth, the place that had been created for all the creatures and for humanity, and she was observing the glories of creation. Something caught her eye, and this was an oyster with its shell open on the sands at the bottom of the sea. But it was not the oyster itself that drew the Holy One, it was the pearl within it, silvery and purple and milky and shining and smooth. God spoke to the oyster who carried this pearl and said, "O oyster, I give you the greetings of this perfect day, and I beg you to tell me what is that which is inside your shell, for I know that I made you, and for certain I did not make that." And the oyster looked at the Elohim and said humbly, "My lady and my delight, it is a pearl that I made myself. I hope it does not displease you." "Displease me?" said God in surprise. "How could anything displease me? All that is of me, and all of me is perfection. But how come you created this pearl, O oyster? I've seen no angel, nor archangel, nor animal, nor fish, nor bird, nor human create in this world of paradise but you." "Well, my lady and my delight," said the oyster, "I opened my shell to drink, and a grain of sand, of perfect sand, flowed in with the water, and it caused me to feel strange and uncomfortable. I tried to expel it, but I couldn't, so I covered it with a part of myself to make it smooth and comfortable instead of irritating, and now I take pleasure in it instead of pain. Is it not beautiful?" "Beautiful," said God. "It's more than beautiful. It's the most wonderful thing that I have ever seen. Thank you, O oyster. You are my teacher, and I am truly grateful." Then the Holy One spent time in contemplation, for the new knowledge that the oyster had given her was a treasure which required full enjoyment. And then she made a decision and knew that it was very, very good. The Elohim moved to the place where the man and the woman lived in peace and harmony with themselves and with the creatures, and she called to them and she spoke to them. Adam, she said, Eve, the greetings of this perfect day to you. I have something to tell you. Do you see that tree over there? The man and the woman greeted the Holy One in turn and in great happiness. And they looked over there, and sure enough, there was a tree, a new tree, which they'd not seen before. It was tall and elegant, and it carried luscious-looking fruits. And they laughed, for they had great joy in anticipation, and they knew how much they would enjoy those fruits. You are not to eat of the tree, said Yahweh Elohim, not one fruit, ever. Now the man and the woman had never heard such a command before. All the Elohim's previous words had been yes to them. They did not understand. It looks good, said the man, perplexed. He felt uncomfortable, and he didn't know what was happening. This is our country, said the woman. You gave it to us. Everything here is ours to enjoy. Not that, said Yahweh, the Lord. And the Elohim's heart melted with compassion, for she saw that her creation experienced distress at this command. But the Holy One also knew with the greatest of joy that what the oyster had taught was true. No, you may not eat from it, said the Holy One, anything but do not eat of that tree. And Yahweh Elohim left the man and woman alone to consider. The Elohim knew immediately that it happened, for Adam Kadmon's soul quickened and life surged into it. The moment the woman and the man ate of the fruit, the divine child began to grow at last. But the Holy One also knew that every cell in Adam Kadmon would have to know grit for the baby to thrive. So Yahweh steeled the Elohim's heart and returned to see the humans and told them that now they had disobeyed, it was time for them to keep practicing this power of choice, and they would leave the world of paradise and be born into a lower world of physical life and death. There they would have to make choices every moment of every day, and through their choices they would design their lives. And their belief in their separation from God would cause them to choose ways either to seek a return to the Holy One or to turn away, for that was the meaning of free will. And as Adam and Eve left the garden to take on their coats of skin and live in the physical world as we do now, Eve took a twig from that wonderful tree in her hand. It was a piece of twig that came off when she pulled at the fruit, and it had a couple of leaves on it. And as she left, she bent down and planted that twig in the ground so that it would grow tall and mighty, becoming a tree of love and a tree of life for humanity that would show us the way back home. And moving on, let us now discuss virgins. Because virgins are kind of important in these stories. Goddesses were frequently virgins in the ancient days. Athena, who's the equivalent of Mars, was a virgin. She vowed virginity, but she had a child, Erichthonius. But this child was given to her by Gaia. She remained a virgin, so we have a virgin birth here. Artemis and Hestia remained as virgins. And the word virgin, as we discussed before, is quite tricky, because in Isaiah, which is the phrase we have, behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. That's read out in churches every Christmas time, Isaiah 7:14. The Hebrew word is Alma, and that simply means young woman. It's translated in Greek when we look at the Gospels as Parthenos, which is generally meant to mean virgin, but doesn't. It means a woman whole and pure, pure in herself. It doesn't mean that you are a virgin. Mary probably was a virgin, but it's not required. And the word for virgin in Hebrew is Bethulah, and that is certainly not used in Isaiah. Now, this virgin story is really interesting because there is a gospel from the Nag Hammadi scrolls, the infancy gospel of James, and it was written approximately 150 years after the birth of Jesus. And I put a link there so you can go on the internet and read it if you want to. So that's on the PowerPoint. And the infancy gospel of James is basically a fantasy story. It's got stuff in it which is wonderful and stuff in it which is woo, which you may agree with in a minute. But in it, Mary is also sired by God. Her parents are named Joachim and Anne, or Anna. And Anna is not fertile, which is another parallel to the women of the Hebrew Testament, who often had a lot of trouble conceiving. In their day, we can be literal about it and say there was an awful lot of intermarriage of brothers and sisters and that kind of thing, which may not have helped the fertility, but I don't think that was still the case when it came to Mary. But Anna prays for a child, and her wish is answered, and she becomes pregnant when her husband is away from home. So there's a strong implication that this is a child sired by the divine, although Anna is not a virgin. So it also goes to show that God doesn't worry about whether you're a virgin or not. But this need myth of virginity is extremely powerful. And Mary is said to have remained a virgin forever. And in the Gospel of James, this is the bit that made my jaw drop the first time I read it. Mary gives birth to the baby Jesus in a cave in the infancy Gospel of James. She's betrothed to Joseph, who swore never to have sex with her. He's much older than her and has children from his first wife who died. This is where we get the background stories of whether Joseph was older and whether Jesus had older brothers and sisters. Although it's not in the canon, it's been quite well known for a long time, and the oral tradition carries these stories. But after the birth of Jesus, the midwife, Emma, calls another woman called Salome to examine Mary to check that she's still a virgin after giving birth. Well, if Mary had given birth to Jesus through her vagina, you really wouldn't be able to tell. And in fact, it's even more true that you can't tell anyway. This legend of a woman's hymen being broken when she first had sex is just a legend. The hymen is a membrane around the entrance of the vagina. In some women, it's quite large. It may break. In others, it's very small. In most women, it stays there forever. In some women, it breaks when you go horse riding. So there's absolutely no physical way you could tell that somebody was a virgin or not. But the Infancy Gospel of James thinks it's so important, they have to prove that Mary remained a virgin. And also in the Gospel, Jesus basically appears in a ray of light, so Mary doesn't have to go through the work of giving birth. The other thing that's really interesting in this Gospel is that Mary was known to be a holy child, and she was taken to the temple at about the age of 3, which was the same age that Samuel went to the temple. His mother Hannah took him, and she lived in the temple until she was just about coming up to puberty, when she was betrothed to Joseph, who took her into his care because they couldn't have blood in the temple. Well, that would be the second temple, not the first temple. But Mary was spinning and weaving in the temple, and she was actually weaving the veil of the temple when Gabriel came for the Annunciation. And fascinatingly, this veil is almost like the hymen. She was weaving this veil to cover the entrance to the Holy of Holies. And when Jesus dies in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, when Jesus dies on the cross, the veil of the temple is torn. It's rent in two. So there obviously must be some symbolism about birth and resurrection, just as we've seen repeatedly in the story of the divine feminine. When Jesus dies and is born into the higher worlds, and then comes back resurrected, then the veil is torn. And it's to show us that as the Christ consciousness is revealed to us, then we don't need priests. We can go into the Holy of Holies ourselves. And Mary, Jesus's mother, just like we've been talking about earlier, is the one who is the mother of the Lord. And we all know the story of the wedding of Cana in John 2:1. And it's the mother of Jesus who actually empowers him to do it. They want wine, and the mother of Jesus says to him, they have no wine. And he says to her, woman, what am I to you? It isn't my hour yet. So that's an interesting way of looking at it. Why he's sort of resisting, isn't he? Sort of going, it's not time yet. But we all know a bit about resistance, because once he steps up, there's no way back. But his mother just quietly says, whatever he says to you, do. And I suspect he went, oh, Mum, and went ahead and did it. So moving on to the next of the Marys, and she's the one that the modern world is so fascinated with, Mary of Magdala, Mary Magdalene, called the apostle to the apostles now, because she was the witness to the resurrection. She was the divine feminine witnessing or giving birth to the resurrected Christ. Now, she also has her own gospel, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, and I put the link to a version of it translated on the internet on the PowerPoint there for you to have a look at if you want to. Very important to know, she's not the woman with the alabaster jar. There's plenty of books, including one by, I think it's Margaret Starbuck or Star something, a whole story about her saying she was the woman with the alabaster jar. But no, that is a misunderstanding. And it's quite simple if you read the Gospel of John, because the woman with the alabaster jar is identified as Mary of Bethany. Mary Magdala certainly did have seven devils turned out of her, if you believe the Gospels. So she wasn't entirely pure and clear, but there's absolutely no evidence that she was a fallen woman in the sense of being a prostitute. And it was Pope Gregory the Great in 1591 who gave this decree that all the Marys, apart from the Virgin Mary, were one Mary, simply because people kept asking, well, which Mary is this and which Mary is that? Miriam or Mariam is a very popular name, certainly was in those days, and Mary is the Greek version of it. And it's very interesting, Miriam means bitter waters and Mariam means strong waters. So these would represent either the waters of chaos of the Great Mother before creation or the waters of the womb in which the baby hovers before it is born. And Mary Magdalene, very unlikely to have been Jesus's wife. Very unlikely, because for several reasons. Firstly, she is one of the women who ministers unto him of her substance. There's a very clear bit in the Gospel of Luke, Luke 8:3, I think, and Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's steward, and Susanna, and many others who, that's hostis, it's feminine, ministered unto him of their substance. And interestingly, it defines Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Susanna, and Mary Magdalene. And because Joanna is married, they attach her to Chuza, Herod's steward. Susanna and Mary are not attached to a man, which implies they're either widowed or divorced. And both widowed and divorced women in Judaism had their own money. They were allowed to inherit. They were allowed to own land, which Greek women and Roman women were not. So Greek and Roman translations of this would not have understood how powerful this was. This was simply saying that this woman was, and Susanna also, was giving her money to support Jesus's ministry. If Mary Magdalene had been Jesus's wife, she would have been Mary of Jesus of Nazareth. She would not have been able to give him her money because it would have been his. She also, in John 20:16, says to Jesus at the time of the resurrection, Rabboni, which is to say master. You don't usually say that to your husband. You'd probably go darling or sweetheart or something like that, but unlikely to go master. Of course, she could have done, but it's moot. And the big bit of evidence that was used in the Gospel of Philip, another of the Nag Hammadis, is that Mary is called Jesus's companion, partner or consort. The Coptic which is the original of this gospel, it uses variants of the word koinonos, which is of Greek origin, or the word otra, of Egyptian origin. And in the passage where she's called Jesus' companion, koinonos is used, and it has a range of meanings. At root, it denotes a person engaged in fellowship or sharing with somebody. It can mean a business partner. It can mean a spouse. It certainly can. It's usually used to refer to a companion in faith or a spiritual companion. In Philemon and in Luke and in Corinthians, in other places, that word is used as a business associate. So in a strange way, that's fairly strong evidence that she wasn't his wife, because the wife was gune, woman or wife. The woman or wife of Jesus would have been the gune, Jesus. And one final thing in the Gospel of Philip, there's that lovely bit where, which is quoted in the Da Vinci Code with the word added, which is, "Why do you love Mary more than us? And why do you kiss her on?" And Dan Brown added the word "the mouth," but that isn't existent in any of the copies of that scroll that exist. It's on the, there's no, it could have been on the cheek, on the hand, could have been on the backside for all we know. We've got no idea. But as I probably said earlier in this course, and if I didn't, I should have, so I'm saying it again, it's most unlikely that anybody would come up to me and look at my husband and say, "Why do you love Maggie more than us, and why do you kiss her on the mouth?" Even if it were mouth. Because it's perfectly obvious, the answer to that, well, because she's my wife and I love her. So I would say, and I've written a whole book about this, the marriage of Jesus, I would say she wasn't his wife. But if you want to believe she's his wife, there's no harm to it. But please also make her his spiritual companion, because there is an echo of this perennial tradition which shows up everywhere in this desire that she should be the mother of the child of Christ. Because as Christ becomes the Christ consciousness, then his betrothed, his wife, should give birth to the next level. But of course, Christos, that aspect of the Christos, is never sent on down through the bloodline. It just doesn't go. Spirit is not passed on through blood. So now we're moving on to the story of Esther. And this is another story, so it's one of these, it's a long story, so please do sit down, be relaxed, make quite sure that you aren't anywhere where you can't just sit down and be relaxed. And I'm going to tell you the story of Esther. And the story of Esther is the story of the first known female Messiah. That's what my teacher, Zev Ben Shimon Halevi, Warren Kenton, said, which was quite breathtaking for a man who was quite Orthodox Jew, especially in his later years. But he said that the way her story is told in the Hebrew Testament and the way the story climbs the tree of life, because it does climb it perfectly, is indicative that she was the axis of her age. The axis of the age is the person who is the closest to the divine. And there are a couple of clues in the book of Esther, because there's 10 chapters, one for each of the Sephirot of the Tree of Life. I doubt that that's a coincidence. And also the story does climb up the tree. And there's a pivotal point in it where Mordecai, Esther's uncle, says to her, "Maybe you are come into the kingdom for such a time as this." Into the kingdom is not a phrase frequently used. It's usually translated nowadays as come into your royal position or your royal apparel, but the word is malkut, which means kingdom. And if you look at the slide, now which number slide is it? That's number 8. We've got the Jacob's ladder there, and there's the four kingdoms, the kingdom of absolute, the divine world at the bottom there, the kingdom of Berea, the heavenly world, which is the kingdom of heaven. We've got the kingdom of the psychological world, kingdom of the psyche, and the bottom, the kingdom of earth, the physical world of Asiya. We don't know whether Mordecai is referring to the kingdom of heaven, which is coming into your true self, where I would imagine it would be that, or the kingdom of God, or it could actually be both working together. But there's nowhere else in the Hebrew Testament where somebody is spoken of as coming into the kingdom. Moses, of course, is seeking a new land, the promised land, and he is believed to be another of the axis of the age of the Hebrew Testament. And interestingly, in those days, a Messiah was expected to save their people from a physical calamity, which of course is what Joseph did, which is what David did through killing Goliath, and what Esther does. And that's one of the reasons why when Jesus was born, nobody really believed he was the Messiah, because they were expecting him to throw out the Romans. They wanted him to be a zealot. They wanted him to save them physically. But the whole of the New Testament is about lifting you up psychologically and spiritually rather than physically. And also, one other thing you can always tell, and we have this perennial tradition now in the modern world, is that you always spot somebody with unusual parenting. There's some adoption going on, or there's a birth which is unusual. So you've got Mary, mother of Jesus, with the unusual birth. You've got Jesus with the unusual birth. You've got Moses being placed in the basket in the bulrushes and adopted by the princess of Egypt. And in Esther's case, she's an orphan adopted by her uncle Mordecai, who's probably her twin soul in this story. And he actually acts as the toxic yin, causing all the problems to her positive yin. And actually she works all the way up the tree. So the story of Esther. The story of Esther takes place at the time of the Babylonian exile. So it's a story that bridges two eras. And Esther and her uncle Mordecai live in the city of Shushan, which is in Persia. And the king of Persia at that time was called Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus was a warrior king. He'd made great conquests across Persia. He conquered parts of the areas of Babylon, which the Jews had been taken to. And therefore, Jewish people in his aegis were not slaves, but they were not high up the social structure either. Now, Ahasuerus, difficult to pronounce, had a wife called Vashti. Now, she was a trophy wife. She was a princess of Persia. He needed, when he took the crown, a wife of royal blood. And Vashti was proud, and she followed the law, which was perfectly acceptable. And Ahasuerus and Vashti did not have children. And there was a great feast at the palace. And to honour the rules of segregation, the men would feast on their own. Perhaps they'd had dancing girls, because, of course, that was accepted. And the women would feast on their own. But we don't know if they had any dancing boys, to be honest. Hopefully they did, but there you go. And during the feast for the men, as boys do, they got into discussion about the beautiful women they knew. And it got into a discussion about which nationality of woman was the most beautiful. And the king, who was obviously rather fond of his wife, or certainly in awe and admiration of her, thought, well, the women of Petra are far more beautiful than the others, and I'm going to prove it. So, foolishly, in his cups, he summoned Vashti to come to him. Now, the law of the time was that a high-born woman might not appear at a place where the men were carousing. And Vashti knew that, and Ahasuerus knew that too, but the laws of the kings overrule all the other laws, so he summoned Vashti to come and to see and to show the men how beautiful she was, and Vashti refused. Now, she was entirely within her rights to do that, but the men around Ahasuerus viewed it as being an insult. And they thought, oh my God, the king's wife disobeyed him. All our wives are having dinner with her. They are also going to disobey us from now on. This can't happen. It simply can't happen. No, no. She's got to be humiliated. She's got to be shown that wives may not do that. Chris, could you mute your audio, please? It's very loud. Thank you. So, the king, feeling shamed and humiliated, with all these men going, oh my goodness, this won't do, this won't do. You've got to divorce her, you've got to divorce her. And being a little tipsy, says, okay, fine, she's divorced. That's it, she's gone. And that was it. That was the end of Vashti. Legend says she went back to Petra on a donkey and her father said, well, why, what are you doing? What on earth are you doing back? Where are all your gold? Where's your jewellery? Where are your wealth? And she said, I brought the donkey back, didn't I? So I rather like Vashti. So Ahasuerus is now single. He's lonely, he's bored. He makes friends with a former slave called Haman, who obviously sucks up to the king big time. And Haman is an Amalekite. And the two become very good friends. And Ahasuerus starts relying far too much on Haman for advice, because Haman is his best friend. And Haman is promoted and promoted and promoted through the ranks. He's not terribly popular until eventually he becomes pretty much the grand vizier of the country. He's second in command to the king. And Haman is an Amalekite. And the Amalekites were one of the nations who were beaten by the Hebrews when they came to the foreign land. So they're an ancient enemy of the Jews. And the Amalekites hate the Jewish nation. Time passes, and all the court knows that the king needs an heir. So he doesn't seem to be wanting to get himself another wife. It doesn't seem to be particularly interesting. So they come up, the courtiers, with a cunning plan, which is that they will hold a kind of beauty contest for all the most beautiful women across the whole kingdom. And the kingdom was so big it took a camel 2 weeks to cross it. So they did this, they caused this great big beauty contest all over the areas ruled by Persia. And young virgins, guess what, virgins, were invited to come to heats in the contest, a bit like Britain's Got Talent or America's Got Talent for beauty, Miss World, if you like, to go and have their teeth looked at and have their nails looked at and to see if they're sensible and beautiful and all that. And the ones who were judged to be the most beautiful were sent off to the court, where they spent a year being purified and soaked in myrrh and frankincense and all sorts of costly things. And then one by one, they were taken before the king, which meant that he got to have dinner, she says euphemistically, with each one of them in turn. And at the end of the evening, the woman went to the harem, because she probably wasn't a virgin anymore. And she stayed in the harem. And that was it for the end of her life. And she never saw the king again unless he called for her. Now, one of the women who took part in this contest was Esther, the niece of Mordecai in the city of Shushan, which was the city where Ahasuerus lived. And the oral tradition around that has Esther saying, I can't do that. We Jews don't marry out. And Mordecai saying, well, the job is to be a tool for the Holy One, to be willing to be used by the Holy One. If he doesn't want you to do this, you won't be selected. And if he does want you to do this, you will be selected. So in that respect, Mordecai's got it spot on. So Esther goes to the competition, and of course, because it's a Cinderella story, she wins and she's sent to the court. She spends her year being purified. And the Bible says quite clearly that when it came to her time to be sent before the king, she went in just what she was wearing. She didn't dress up. She didn't cover herself in unguents. She went as her true self. And as she went as her true self, she shone. The king fell in love with her and proclaimed that she was the one that he was going to marry and she would become the queen. Now, here's the rub. This is the thing, of course, that makes it actually a story, because all the great stories have to have the hero or the heroine telling a fib somewhere along the time, which causes misunderstandings. Mordecai charges Esther, when she goes off to the beauty contest, not to tell anyone she's a Jew. And when she sends a message to him saying that she is to be the next queen, he reinforces that with another messaging telling her, do not tell her of Do not tell him of your kindred or your people. And this is the big mistake that Esther says. This is the Yesodic state. She doesn't tell the king who she is. So she marries him not on false pretenses, but without saying who she is, what her customs are, what her beliefs are. This is not a good start to a marriage. Now, in the meantime, Mordecai goes to the gates of the city every day to ask after the health of the queen. He says he's not going to be in touch with her because otherwise it would, letters going backwards and forwards would reveal that she was Jewish. So he instructs her not to be in touch with him. And he sits at the gates every day and he talks to the guards and always says, what is the health of the queen? And the message goes and the message comes back, the queen is very well. And sitting at the gate, he overhears the guards discussing a plot to kill the king. And Mordecai listens, hears the details, and sends the details to Esther. And she is able to warn the king that he's about to be assassinated. And the king trusts her and checks it out and has guards around. And the attempt is made and the men are arrested. And the king goes to Haman and says, this was amazing, the queen was sent a message, and the message was sent by a man called Mordecai in the street of the camels. You are to reward Mordecai with much gold and property in thanks. And Haman doesn't. The reason why Haman doesn't is because Haman, in all his riches and wealth, rides out of the palace most days into the street, and because he's Grand Vizier, people are meant to bow to him. And there's this scruffy little Jewish guy, Mordecai, who won't. Mordecai will not bow to Haman because Haman, he knows, is an Amalekite. So Mordecai's pride is the source of the rest of the whole story. Mordecai's negative tiferet pride. He will not bow to anybody who is an enemy of his people. That's both Tiferet and Yesod. That's what's known as the path of honesty between Yesod and Tiferet in Kabbalah. You have to have integrity. Now, Mordecai is holding it that he has integrity in not bowing to Haman, but he lives in the country under which the laws are that you bow to the vizier. So it's a kind of a moot point, but you're really asking for trouble if you're not going to bow to an Amalekite and you're a Hebrew. And Haman hates Mordecai. He's found out about his name. He was planning to have him quietly executed. And guess what? The king has just told him that this very person is the person that he has to reward. And Haman just doesn't. And Haman talks to his wife Zeresh about it. And he complains and moans. And Zeresh, as the perfect negative yin, points out to him that the best way to hide a tree is in a forest. So Haman goes away and he thinks, I wonder. And he starts poisoning the king's mind about the Jewish people. He tells him that they don't worship like us. They don't. They take days off when they want to. They're bad. They're rotten. They're wicked. They're this. They're that. And the king, who is actually a weak king, a powerful warrior, but a weak king, says, well, you know, you whatever you think. So Haman takes the royal seal and delivers a proclamation that all the Jewish folk in the whole of Persia are to be annihilated and that the citizens are to kill them. Now, this edict is to happen several weeks ahead because, again, it takes a camel 2 weeks to travel to the far ends of Persian land. And the massacre was to take place on the one day. So the camels go out and the proclamation is put up on the same day throughout the whole of the country, and there is a 2-week warning. Mordecai reads this and sends a message to Esther, and what he says to her is, this is your time. Go to the king. And Esther sends the following message back to him. I cannot go to the king. The laws of the Medes and the Persians are such that nobody may approach the king without his permission, and I have not been called to him these 30 days. Now, if she hasn't been called to the king in 30 days, the strong implication is they've had a quarrel, because Esther hasn't had a child yet. They've been married 3 or 4, maybe 5 years, it's not quite certain. So they really should be still trying for a child. So something has gone wrong if she hasn't been called to the king. And Esther says, I can't do it. So Mordecai messages back to her, and this is what it says in the Bible. He writes, "If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained the kingdom for such a time as this?" So it could be you are a queen for such time as this, but I think it's actually talking about the kingdom of heaven. She has to come to herself, to be her true self. And this is where Esther moves into the soul triad of the Kabbalistic tree of life. She has to come into her true self and use discernment and loving kindness for her people in the risk of losing her own life, and discernment in how to do it. Because the laws of the Persians are, if you go before the king without his permission, you will be killed unless he says not. So Esther sends a message back to Mordecai and says, "Very well, pray for me for 3 days. And at the end of the 3 days, I will be in the kingdom and I will go before the king. And if I die, I die." And Esther spends those 3 days, while the people pray for her, going within, secluding herself, cleansing herself emotionally, getting her courage up, getting her discernment, her strength up. And then on the 3rd day, she puts on her malkut and very likely her royal apparel as well. She gets into her malkut and she walks in dignity and beauty to where the king is trying cases in the public hallway of the palace. She walks to the door and the guards cross their spears in front of her and look to the king in horror because they know this is the queen. And they also know that the king has got rid of one previously unwanted wife. The king looks up and sees Esther, looks her in the eye, realizes she's probably come to apologize, or at least she's come in all humility. That's the kingdom of heaven, all humility. And he points his staff towards her. The spears are withdrawn and Esther walks into the room. My God, what she must have felt at that point. And the king says to her, "Queen Esther, what is it you want of me?" Now, that's the point where if we weren't in the kingdom of heaven, if we weren't in our true Tiferet, we'd probably blurt something out, "Save the people, save the Jews, I'm a Jew." And boy, that would not have gone well. But Esther uses gevurah, discernment, discrimination, the power of the divine feminine. And she says quite simply, "Only that you and my lord Haman would come to supper with me tonight, my lord." And the king's really amused at this, that the woman would risk her life to ask him to dinner. And he's absolutely thrilled. And he says, yes, he speaks for Haman as well. So Esther goes away and plans a sumptuous dinner for them. And the king and Haman go. Obviously, there will be slave girls around because you can't be there with a woman on your own. Oh, no, not in those lands. But anyway, they go for dinner and they have a really good time. And Haman's dead chuffed because the queen has invited him as well. That makes him even more important. And at the end of the evening, the king is obviously thinking, "Well, I'm back with my wife. This is lovely." And he says to her at the end of the evening, "Queen Esther, I will give you anything up to half my kingdom. What would you like? Because this has been such a lovely evening." And it shows that he's a daft what's it, really, because that's an extremely over-the-top offer. And of course, Esther could at least at that moment have said, "Save the Jews." And he would have been stuck and he would have resented her and he would have hated her. And it would have been a real big problem. And he would have gone, "Oh, so you only invited me to dinner so you could get what you want from me." So Esther just says, "My lord, my request of you is simply that you would both come to dinner and we can do this again tomorrow." And the king is chuffed to bits. Absolutely, really thrilled. And he wants to stay the night with Esther. But some intervening genius stops that happening. Haman is obviously suddenly jealous of the queen. We don't know the sexual proclivities of Haman, but he's suddenly jealous of the queen at that point. And he persuades the king that there's some business that he has to come away with. Remember, the king is a weak man. He's under Haman's power now. So the king doesn't stay with his wife. He goes off for some business. And later that night, annoyed and frustrated probably, he goes to bed and he can't sleep. So he sends for a slave and tells him to go to the Book of Records and find a very old scroll, one from right at the back of the Book of Records, to read him a story about the kingdom, either in his time or previously, something that will entertain him. And the slave goes to the Book of Records, the Room of Records, and fossicks around at the back of a cupboard and finds a scroll covered in dust, and pulls it out and takes it to the king and starts reading it. And it's the story of how Mordecai passed on the message that the king was under danger of assassination. And the king is furious. He says to the slave, I told you to get an old one. That's a new story. That's practically only a couple of years old. What's the matter with you? And the slave says, oh, my lord, it was covered in dust, I promise you. And the king looks at it and says, that's very true. It is. And he starts to wake up. And he says to the slave, go find out what was given to Mordecai of the Street of the Camels in recompense. The slave rushes off and does that, and the news comes back to the king that nothing was given to Mordecai. And the king goes, okay, and sets a little trap for Haman. Haman comes up to him. The king says, Haman, if you had somebody you knew whom you revered above all others, who you wanted to reward for their sterling service to you, what would you do for them? I need your advice here. And Haman, thinking it's him, really jumps off the top of his ego and says, oh, my lord, I would put my royal crown on their head and put them on my horse to be led around the city, being proclaimed that they had the king's favour. And the king looks at Haman and susses him out for good, that he wants to wear the crown and ride the king's horse. So he says to Haman, good, great idea. Go see that that's done for Mordecai from the Street of the Camels. Poor old Haman has to do it. So about 10 days before the massacre is due to start, the Jewish folk of Shushan see Mordecai from the Street of the Camels paraded around the city on the king's horse with the king's crown on their head. So they begin to think there might be a little bit of hope going on here. And that night, there is another dinner. Haman is a little bit chastened for sure, and the king's having a great time. At the end of the evening, he says, Queen Esther, I will give you up to half my kingdom if I may just dine with you again tomorrow. Now, that's a man who's back in love with his wife. That's a man who's understanding humility. That's a man who's realised that he's been an idiot. What does Esther do? Because you and I would just go, oh, please, my Lord, save my people. Esther says, my Lord, if it were within my power to do that, I would do so. But I cannot, because tomorrow I leave the palace and I go back to my people, because I am sentenced to death. And the king goes, what do you mean? You're the queen of Persia. Who would sentence the queen of Persia to death? And she says, you have, my lord. You and Haman, I am a Jewess. I'm going back to my people because I am sentenced to death. So I'm sorry, I can't have dinner with you tomorrow. Wow. The king gets up and runs out of the room because so much is going on in his head at that point. And the laws of the Medes and the Persians are immutable. He can't just say, change that law. So he runs out into the courtyard to think. And Haman, who's already been humiliated that day, goes, oh, well, I don't know what he said, but he throws himself on Esther to beg her for mercy. And she says to him, don't beg me, because the decision is not made. One of us will probably die tonight or soon, but we don't know which it is. At which point the king comes back into the room, sees Haman throwing himself on Esther, thinks he's trying to attack her. And that his mind is already made up, but that's the absolute final straw. So he calls the guards and says, basically, take this man out and hang him. And that's the end of Haman. And then the king says to Esther, what can we do? The laws of the Medes and the Persians are absolutely immutable. And Esther says, there will be a way around it. And I know a wise man who may be able to help. And the king says, oh, yes, who's that? And she says, Mordecai from the Street of the Camels. He's my uncle. So they summon him and they work out another cunning plan, which is that they send very fast camels out, flat out, to say that the Jewish people may resist and that they're giving them very fierce weapons. So in the end, the massacre doesn't happen. And that's basically the story of Esther. And it's a lovely story because it's about a woman actually learning what to do after she marries her prince, how to step into her power. And if you ever wanted to read a non-biblical version by an amazing author, British author, who died back in the 1980s, her name is Nora Lofts. There's a link there to Amazon Co. UK, but you could find it on .com or in your local bookshop. It was written for teenagers, but it's the most beautiful retelling of this story, and it adds a wonderful amount to it, which I absolutely love. So I'm going to stop the share for the moment and ask you if you've got any questions before we have the homework. Any thoughts, comments or questions on that?
Incredible story.
Thank you. Well, I didn't write it.
Yeah, wait.
Okay, we'll go on to we'll go back to the homework then, if that's all right with you guys. Your homework, this is completely optional. I mean, all your homework is optional. But what I would like you to do is to burn incense resin during meditation, rather than a joss stick. You can get resin, frankincense resin, all sorts of other resins quite easily on the internet, because we're currently in lockdown in the United Kingdom, not in Wales, I know, so it's Great Britain, or no, it's England, isn't it? Yes, England. So you might have to get it off the internet. But it's a supremely beautiful experience to have resin incense, and you can have all sorts of it. You can have frankincense, myrrh, mixtures. Buckfast Abbey in Devon has its own mix, which is exquisite. And I'm going to request that you listen to a piece of music while meditation. It's called the Hymn to the Divine Mother. And this sort of brings in a culture which we haven't examined on this course, which is the Indian goddesses. It's sung in Sanskrit. I think it's very beautiful. If you can't stand it, just find yourself another Hymn to the Divine Mother on YouTube. But the link is there. That link has got word translations of the Sanskrit. They aren't accurate, but they're very beautiful. So your homework is to spend 10 minutes listening to this hymn while burning incense, and just to sit remembering that story of Esther, and remembering the importance of coming into your kingdom, coming to yourself, because when you do that, you have the divine attribute of the strong yin and the strong yang of the soul, and you can match them together so that the outcome of what it is you want to achieve can be blessed by grace. And that's the end of tonight. Next week, we're going back to nature. We're going to work with Mother Nature. And we're going to do some work with fairies and pixies and possibly some elves. So thank you very much for listening. I'm going to stop the recording now, and I shall see you next week.